Who you calling crazy?
Welcome to Who You Calling Crazy. This is a unique mental health podcast. We are erasing the stigma and elevating and normalizing dialogue around mental health. Of course, we'll be sharing practical therapy tips, but most importantly, we'll be diving into the stories and vulnerability of people you know or want to know. I'm your host, Juliette Kuhnley. Hi, listeners. It has been several weeks since we've released a new episode, and that is on me. And I kind of just wanted to address that for a minute because the COVID finally caught me and some of my family, and it laid me out for several weeks. So I have an underlying autoimmune disease, and I think that's what made it incredibly miserable. So I tested positive for 11 days and could not do much of anything. And I still have some lingering stuff. Then on top of that, the world just continued to suck. And there was just so much heaviness. So, you know, we had the Buffalo shooting, then we had the anniversary of George Floyd's murder, and then the elementary school shooting, and 20 mass shootings since then. And I've done a couple interviews around, like, what are we supposed to do with that? And the short answer is, I don't fucking know. Like, I am struggling as well. So sometimes I just disappear from this space because it's too much. But we're back and, like, really excited about this guest because we were just talking before we started recording that we've known each other since second grade, which is crazy. So there are some things we will not allow on air. Just kidding. Just kidding. But okay, so I'll have you just go ahead and introduce yourself. Tell us what you do and we'll go from there.
Okay. I'm doing my math real quick because I'm like, okay, it's 30 years.
That sounds like so many years.
I know. So
okay, 30 years.
30 years.
And it's like really because of Instagram that we're kind of like reintroduced back into each other's lives. So this is like the positive of social media.
Yeah. Because, well, and I guess we lived in the... So we grew up in the same town. Okay, I'm Erin Simpson. I'm a mom, author, writer, artist, Jill of all trades. Can't pick one thing, so I try to do it all to my detriment. But you and I grew up in the same town, went to school second grade together, and then your family moved. You went to a different school, same town, just different school. And then same high school. And then we didn't really... We kept up, but like we didn't connect again until we were both in Charlotte.
Yeah.
And you had me do some paintings for friends of yours, which was really awesome.
Amazing.
And then, and that really fun one I did for your father-in-law, I guess.
That was
his retirement gift or something.
Yeah. And you did one for my parents, like for their 40th anniversary.
Oh, yeah. So fun stuff. Uh-huh. And then, and then I watched you transition to mom and then therapist. And then now here we are talking about mental health.
I know. I think we just have this mutual admiration of using our platforms, whatever that looks like, but to be just really honest about mental health. So, but that, I'm glad that you could keep up with that journey. And were we in Girl Scouts together?
Uh-huh. Because we had, and that's where we have some of the mutual friends that we still talk with, like Laura. And yeah.
My biggest memory when I think about our friendship is your Easy Bake Oven.
And I forget that I had one.
I remember that. And your mom was also an artist. And I still have a portrait that she did of me. And I remember like looking at her jewelry and stuff too, like as a little second, third grader.
Yeah, because she had a bunch of my, we did. And she had my mom or her like grandma's old jewelry boxes and stuff. So there was great like costume jewelry in there.
Yes, I remember that.
Do you remember the, and I'm only going to say this because this is like one of those core memories that whenever anybody's like, oh, do you like to do X, Y, Z? I'm like, no, because this one time I did this thing and it was a freaking nightmare. Uh-huh. That Girl Scout camp where we were in like the tent on stilts kind of thing at the lake. Mm-hmm. And like we had to shower with girls that were like way older than us. And like, I got heat rash. We were supposed to be there for like 2 weeks. I think I made it one. I was like, get me the fuck out of here.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know if I can say the F word, but and there was that, we woke up in the middle of the night to that brrr sound in the tent. And it was that bug that was like the size of our head.
Gosh. And this might
like,
be
never camping again.
This ever. Might be the same one where I peed in the sleeping bag. I wet the sleeping bag.
I don't know. I would not be surprised. That was the worst experience. everybody's like, I love camp. I love getting, no.
Yeah. I have a visceral anxious reaction as you talk about it. So yes, I can feel it. Even if I can't remember all of those details, remember my shame though, at pee in my sleeping bag.
Oh, who was the worst?
Yeah.
Yes. I could not remember the name. I can see the counselors. I still have pictures.
Gross.
And I'm just like, I hated every second of that experience.
Yeah. And so you and I have never camped again. On our own or with each other. Yeah. So we can talk about, there's a lot there, showering with the older girl. Like, what the hell? Anyway, but I do remember some other like dramatic things that were just like family of origin stuff for both of us. But I don't know. I'm just going to like start us off. Like, give me a rundown of like what you think of when you just start to think about like your journey with your own mental health, mental illness, whatever, starting from a young age.
That's a tough one because I have thought about that a lot, especially in the last year and a half, because I lost my mom in December 2020. And then September 2021, I lost my dad. So less than a year, both parents gone. And it's weird when people die, because part of it, you're just like grieving. And then the other part, you're like, you're angry for a lot of reasons. But so there, I've been trying to unpack all of that and figure out, how the hell did I end up where I am?
Because your relationship with dad is complicated.
Very. And so is the relationship with my mom. So long story short, my parents met in college. My mom was an American, grew up in the Midwest in like Chicago area. My dad was Turkish, grew up in Turkey, and came over here for undergrad, met my mom. They whirlwind, fell in love. My mom, you know, wanted adventure, so she married him. They moved to Turkey. A couple of years later, they had me. Then they had my brother. And my dad was abusive. And the reason I struggle with saying that is because I understand where that came from now. Because when I suffered from postpartum depression, I understood how he was able to do what he did. It doesn't excuse it, but I understand what might have triggered some of his more severe reactions. And I see now that as an adult, 90% of it was fear. Like, his trigger to a feeling of fear or out of control was just rage.
Yep.
Because the other 85% of the time, he was like jovial and cheery and silly and charming and everything's great. But like when he felt like he was losing that control or just afraid something was going to happen, like anytime my brother or I got hurt, his initial reaction was like rage. And it wasn't because he was mad at us that we were hurt. It was because I don't know what to do.
Yeah. Like, out of
and I, yeah, I have to catch myself now as a mom, the same thing. Like when they fall or they're hurt or they run out into the street or whatever, my first like instinct is to be like angry, but just because I'm like, oh my God, please don't die. Like just, I don't, when I feel out of control, my instinct is rage now.
Yeah.
And that is something that I have to fight constantly.
Yeah. And it gives you a different lens and framework for understanding his behavior, which can be really confusing as an adult, because there's that introduction of compassion and yet there's still very much the woundedness that from that inner child.
Right. But it helps explain why as a kid, I was always so confused about how I felt about my dad, because I did love him. I love my dad. My mom always told me that when I was little, that's who I went to for comfort. When I woke up in the middle of the night and had a nightmare, I ran to my dad. I didn't run to my mom. I ran to my dad. Like, I knew that as angry and as upset as he got, that he was going to keep us safe. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, so it was just two different split. I don't know. Yeah. It was just really weird.
That's very confusing for a child, especially.
And then there was my mom, who, when there was abuse happening, getting yelled at, getting spanked, whatever, she was the quiet observer in the corner saying, I'm not getting involved. When you're a child looking for somebody to intervene on your behalf and they're not doing it, that creates a lot of problems for your adult and child self. Like,
great point.
You start to not trust anybody. You feel like you're on your own. It's up to you to handle it. And that's something that I am still struggling with at 37, married for how long have we been married? I think it was 8 years this year together, 10, a while, but that's still something that I have to fight. He's like, you're not alone. I'm here with you. And like, it's just something that I still have to wrestle with, because that was something I dealt with for so long.
Yeah. So that core belief was rooted of, I can't count on anybody else.
And so when I met you in the second grade, my mom and brother and I had just moved from Turkey to the United States. And I found out when my mom was battling her terminal cancer, my aunt told me that the reason we stayed when we stayed was we had come over for like a family summer vacation thing. So we came with just like bare minimum in the suitcase. I had a backpack and two toys. And my aunt was like listening to my mom tell her about everything that was going on. And she was like, well, if you feel like you need to go back, I get it, but you can't take Aaron back to that space. Like that's no. And so that's why my mom decided to stay. I didn't know that until I was 36. But because of that decision, I found out that when I was 16, that my mom resented me for us leaving. We had a fight. My mom was very passive aggressive. She would shut up, clam up, block you out for hours, days, whatever, when there was a fight. And one day I had just had enough. I was 16 and I was like, could you fucking tell me why we keep fighting like this? Because I can't do this anymore. This sucks so bad. And that's a child saying that to their mother. And she was like, well, maybe it's because I resent you for leaving your dad. And I was like, damn. Ugh. It was like a slap. It felt like a physical slap. I just said, okay. And I just walked out and I processed it 2 years later by writing an essay in college for one of my English classes about it. And I let her read it and I got a, you know, I'm sorry I said that. Not an, of course not, not a, you know, I know it's not your fault. Da, 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 da. It was like, I shouldn't have said that because it made me look bad. And
so that's a big burden to carry. It's a big burden for you.
Yeah. Well, and she felt it until the day she died. Like the last conversation that I had with her when she was lucid, she was saying that she thought if she had done things the way that Michael and I do, like we had just gone to Savannah for an anniversary trip. And she was like, oh, I think if your dad and I had done that more, we would have stayed together. And I was like, in what world? Like it just, that was the hardest thing about growing up as her daughter was that she rewrote the narrative of every experience that we shared, that she lived, that, you know, none of it was seen realistically. Mm-hmm. Like everything was romanticized in one way or another, you know, bad or good. Like,
right.
And she painted herself. I mean, I loved my mom. She was a great person. She was a great teacher. She loved her students. She just was not tremendous as a mother sometimes.
Yeah. And was that her, those were her survival mechanisms?
It had to be because she never did therapy. And I begged her to, especially when she was diagnosed with cancer. And she did. And I'll never forget one time. She was like, well, there's people with real problems who need it more than me. And I'm like, no, no, I don't think that's how this works. Like, because I've been in therapy since I was 12. Because the first time I went, she took me to fix me. Like, what's wrong with her that we can't stop fighting?
Right.
And so I got to listen to her and the therapist tell me.
Here's what you could do differently.
Yeah. And like, let's put a teenager on, what was it, Paxil? That was fun. Mm-hmm. Numbing.
Yep.
So
not a lot of ownership at all from mom.
No, none. None, none, none.
So in that, did she color your relationship with your dad then? Like, was it her messaging or were you, what was the distance there?
I think for me, that was a survival mechanism. I was hurt by what had happened, that they weren't together anymore and that I had no relationship with him. A lot of that was safety. I think my family over here was worried about us being not kidnapped, for lack of a better word, you know, and being taken back to Turkey. And
so that's what I remember. I remember. I remember.
Yeah.
Hiding.
We had a fake assumed last name. Mm-hmm. There was a flag in my thing at school. I had to have a bathroom buddy, like all through elementary school. And I think it was like, I don't know that that was ever an active threat. I know that it was a concern. And I know that my dad would have loved to get us back to Turkey, but I don't think it was at the cost of taking us from my mom. I think, but I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, that's one of those things. But I think the thing that made it seem more real was his attorneys were perusing our town, seeing where we live, where we went to school, that kind of stuff. So that made it feel very imminent.
Yeah. Cause I remember that. I remember hiding sometimes. And like, I would imagine as a child, I mean, just your sense of safety and again, the trust, like, cause that message is communicating my dad can't be trusted. mm-hmm. or he's capable of something really scary of like ruining my world. It's hard then to try to reestablish a sense of just internal safety, I would imagine.
Yeah. And I feel like that went on until like sixth grade, I think, is when their divorce was like finalized and it was like everything's done. And there was basically zero contact between them, like my Turkish family and me, mm-hmm. until September 11th, 2001. That summer before that, I had gone to Austria for a theater exchange camp. And I met all these amazing kids from, I think we had like 20 different countries represented there. It was awesome. And so when 9/11 happened, I just remember being like, oh my God, am I going to get to see my friends again? Because I just knew that so much was going to change. Yeah. And then I was like, shit, like my dad. And so I emailed with the help of my mom. We found a doctor that he used to work with when we still lived there. And I sent him an email through the hospital system over there and he sent it to my dad. And my dad and I started communicating.
That's a lot of years later.
Uh-huh. So I was 18. I had just been accepted to, I think, UNC Greensboro. So their alma mater. And he had said that he would help pay for school, which was huge because mm-hmm. it had been 12 years, no child support, mm-hmm. you know, because there you can't enforce it internationally.
Wow.
So yeah, in all that time, I watched my mom be a single mom working multiple jobs, trying to keep things normal and spend a lot of time with other people's kids during the school year, which I didn't realize I had a problem with until probably much later.
Yep. Like that you could see that as that's where she poured her energy, uh-huh. her nurturing energy.
Yeah.
So then you rebuilt relationship. Well, built a relationship with dad.
Yeah. We pretty much started from scratch. Totally. Yeah. And it went back and forth. It was not easy. We fought a good bit because I think we were both, you know, I'm sure for him having last seen me when I was 6 and a half, then you have this mouthy like 18-year-old who thinks she knows everything and is trying to figure out who she is as a person. That's a lot of butting heads. But I did finally go back over there for the first time in 2004. My brother and I did together and we spent like a New Year's holiday before school started back with him. And it was pretty fun. We met his new wife and she was great. He had a dog, which was amazing because we were never allowed dogs when we were kids. And yeah, it was just fun. And, but when we went back, well, and then in between that, they had come over to the States for a conference. So we got to see them in DC and like have a really fun weekend up there. And then we went back in 2006 or 2007. I think 2007. Oh, he did surprise me for my college graduation. And that was the first time my mom and him saw each other.
Whoa.
In however many years that is.
And did they keep it together?
Yeah. My mom awkwardly went up to him and said, you know, thanks for helping Aaron through all of this.
Okay.
And, but that was it. It was like, okay. I had one family over here. It was my dad and his sister. And I had my family over here, my yep. friends. My friends were like, what do we do? This
yeah.
is so weird. So
God, so there's so much about, I mean, there's so much grief in like all of these threads and rebuilding.
And when, so the second time we went over there, he just basically worked the whole time. So we ended up spending most of our time with our stepmom, which was fine, but awkward because she didn't speak a lot of English. She spoke English. It was just broken English. It wasn't great. And then, and I was really pissed at him. I was like, we flew all the way over here and you couldn't be bothered to spend undisturbed time with us. And so we had a huge fight and then we didn't talk for a couple of years after that. Mm-hmm. And then I had a cervical cancer scare and I needed some help with medical bills because I was a broke reporter and I had just shitty health insurance, no money, mm-hmm. whatever. I was like, Dad, please help. Mm-hmm. And so we did. And then from that moment on, we started to keep better tabs on each other, check in more often without an agenda. And that was kind of a reset for us both. And then he divorced, didn't tell me, and then remarried to a woman whose kids I had known when we lived in Turkey. Okay. So she's fabulous. That has been one of the coolest things to come out of the last year is she has kind of taken on the stepmom role and been like, I'm going to help you through this process, because the estate thing between here and Turkey is insane. And she's been incredibly helpful and kind. And we talk weekly, FaceTime when we can. I was going to go visit her this summer. Wow. And then I got scared of COVID numbers again. So
yeah,
we're going to wait. But yeah, that's been a neat thing to come out of that.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And we were, my dad and I were, he would send like dad jokes on the WhatsApp chat thing and like pictures. And we had talked just like 3 days before I got the call saying he'd had a heart attack.
So it was totally sudden.
Oh, it was just the worst.
And
I think just, yeah.
I was going to say, you were still in the depths of your grief from mom too.
Mm-hmm. So, and I couldn't stop crying when I got that call. Like with mom, I had been expecting it. Mm-hmm. She'd been sick for like 3 years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we'd had so many false alarms with her
because
the cancer was just so bad that when it finally happened, it was like, but then that call about my dad, it just floored me. And I think everybody was shocked because I wasn't, you know, as physically or emotionally as close to my dad as I had been to my mom. But it was just such a shock. And because he was only like 64 or something. And it was just so sudden. I was not prepared to lose another parent.
Sure. I think that's the feeling, right? Is that all of a sudden I'm without parents.
Like, yeah.
That's hard for people like to grasp. Open.
Yeah. And yes, I still have family, but I have an amazing support system. I don't want anybody who hears this to feel, to sound like I am ungrateful for the people that I have in my life. It's just so different. And so even those fractured relationships that I had with my parents, there was still a level of comfort that when shit was topsy-turvy, I would reach out and be like, will you just talk to me about what's happening? Because nothing makes sense right now.
Yeah. There's still some sense of being tethered when you have your family, your parents. Mm-hmm. And then when you don't, it feels incredibly untethered.
Yeah. Especially when you have the last 2 years of absolute shit show, whatever the fuck is happening in this country, to not have my parents to talk to about any of it has been just the weirdest thing.
Yep. So then your own journeyhood to becoming a parent.
Yeah.
Because what was modeled for you and what you experienced as a child, how did that set you up for your own journey?
You know, I grew up being like, well, I don't want to be like them. And so I went into parenthood thinking the same thing, but my pregnancy was fine with my first. I did have gestational diabetes, so that was like a pain, but it was fine. It was manageable, but I feel like it all started in the delivery room. Mm. So I went in just like such crazy pain that nobody had explained to me before what it was going to feel like. So I like freaked out and I got an epidural, even though I probably shouldn't have, because I was 6.5 centimeters. I could have probably pushed through and been fine. Instead, got the epidural, which made actual, when it came time to push, impossible because I couldn't feel a freaking thing. So I did a lot of damage down there trying to get my son out. Mm-hmm. So my physical recovery after he was born was really tough. And then he was the hungriest freaking baby. Like that child fed constantly. I mean, I basically lived in our recliner so that I would be able to like feed him and not, you know, drop him, but still doze for like the first 6 weeks because it was just constant. And I had been fed I did all the classes because I worked for Levine at the time. And so I got all the classes for free through the hospital and did them all. And they're all like breastfeeding, 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 breastfeeding. And so I was like, yeah, I'm going to breastfeed for a whole year. Yeah. Going to do it. Mm-hmm. And then Dean ended up with a whole bunch of like food intolerances. And so I had to give up soy. I had to give up nuts. I had to give up just anything. Mm-hmm. And then I ended up, because I was eating such a limited diet while still trying to breastfeed, I was so stressed, not sleeping. I developed a hiatal hernia. Mm-hmm. So like literally I couldn't eat. I would eat and then I would just be like dry heaving because I was like, I couldn't. It was terrible. And I was so sleep deprived. I did not sleep that entire first year, like more than 4 hours a night. And one time my mom came to visit and I was telling my mother-in-law about this the other night. My mom came to visit and I guess it was a Saturday because Michael wasn't working. And so I basically was like, hey, mom. And just, I could not physically wake up. I was on the couch the entire time. I could not wake up. And I don't remember what my mom had said, but she was like, well, you just do what you have to do. Like, you just get up and do it. And I was like,
it's not that simple.
Yeah. And yeah. I think it was kind of after that where Michael was like, I don't think you're just tired. Like, this isn't normal. And that was really frustrating. And
because so leading helpless.
Up to that, yeah. Leading up to that point, I had, you know, reached out to my OBGYN and said, I'm miserable. I'm not sleeping. I am just so anxious all the time because I didn't fully disclose everything because my OBGYNs were also male and that's who my checkups were with. And the first guy told me, well, you know, it's stress. You're a new mom. You don't want to treat the symptoms. You want to treat the cause. And I'm like, I have a newborn. What the fuck does that mean? Like, what am I supposed to do with that? And because like at night I would be afraid to go to sleep because I knew I was just going to have to wake up. And then if I did fall asleep, I would wake up in a panic being like, did I leave him in the bed? Did I squish him? Right. Like, is he breathing? If he was in the, you know, little bassinet by the side.
So the cycle was just endless.
Endless. I would be, to the point where I was like afraid to like walk across. Like our room was on one side of the house. His room was just on the other side of the hallway, but I had to walk past like the stairwell and I would be so terrified of the stairs. Mm-hmm. Like I was afraid I was going to fall. If I was carrying him, I was afraid we were going to fall. I was going to drop in. Like everything was just fear, 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 fear. And then there would be nights where like he wouldn't sleep. And I mentioned this in the book that I wrote, It's Good Moms Have Bad Days. And there was a point where I was so angry at this baby that was just screaming, crying that I had to like, I took a step back from the crib and I like hit myself in the head to get me to like literally snap out of it. Cause I was like, you cannot be mad at this child. It is not the child's fault. This is just what happens. This is on you. And so somewhere in the midst of all of that, when my husband was like, this isn't normal, you shouldn't be feeling like this, we need to get you some help.
Yeah.
That I went on the, well, I Googled like postpartum something. I don't know exactly what, but I found Postpartum Support International and a local coordinator through that, reached out to them, got a therapist within like 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And then the day that I got the call to schedule the appointment, I found out I was pregnant with number two.
Oh,
and I was like, fuck.
My God. Right.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So it's hard in this country to get a true assessment of postpartum anxiety, postpartum depression, postpartum psychosis. And that seems to have kind of become part of your life's work is raising awareness around some of that. Is that fair?
Yeah. Because I think all of the postpartum mood disorders are so similar and they mask other disorders, like, or mimic other disorders rather, where you could go in and a psychiatrist is going to diagnose you bipolar just outright instead of being like, yes, caused by the postpartum shift or whatever. And so the treatment and the therapy that needs to happen after that, it's not modeled specifically towards these things. And so that makes the recovery road a lot longer than it needs to be for moms. So like when I was diagnosed in Charlotte, I had a great talk therapist, Judith Thorne, I think is her name, because I know you're still in Charlotte. So if you have Charlotte listeners, she was great. But she referred me to a psychiatry group in Charlotte also who diagnosed me as manic depressive brought on by postpartum.
Okay.
And she treated me with Zoloft and listened, checked like my vitals every visit, like was really just like, you just had a baby. Your body is going through insane things right now. We're going to track all of it.
Yes.
And it was phenomenal. And then we had to move to fucking Texas for my husband's job. And all of that like good tender care that I was getting kind of, you know, so long, farewell.
So again, you must have felt like you were flailing, but I just want to pause too, because we don't talk enough about like what they call the fourth trimester, you know, which is really just the 12 weeks after you have a baby, but there's so much attention put on the baby, which understood, and not enough on the mom who has just endured this, like oftentimes physically traumatic thing Mm-hmm. I mean, pushing a baby, however you birth a baby, whatever.
Right.
It's a big ass deal for your body. And then your hormones, the emotional components on top of it. And there's just not enough attention. And when you were saying the thing about breastfeeding, I was thinking, yes, like that. It's the most unnatural, natural thing ever. And so right. many of us feel so incompetent or because, you know, and I had such a complicated relationship with breastfeeding as well, that you just, I hear in your stories, like there's so much blame and shame.
Well, and they tell you it's not supposed to hurt. And
oh,
I'm like,
fuck that.
Really? Because they're cracked and bleeding. Mm-hmm. Is that supposed to feel good? Mm-hmm. Like, have you breastfed a baby? Because right. I think you're full of shit.
Right. Like, mine look like battlefields now. So thank you. But there's so much shame and blame and guilt for new parents in that transition. So yeah. So it's, I think being able to ask for help, but it sounds like also you were at a place where you didn't even know that was necessarily what you needed to do. And your husband was able to name it.
Yeah. I thought I was just tired. I thought I was just exhausted, but my husband was more able to see the extreme shifts and that manic kind of behavior. Yeah. And so, yeah, that it was, we got the right help, thankfully.
Yeah. So what do people do? I mean, especially in all of your conversations with women around this stuff. And I love that, you know, good moms have bad days. It's like a mantra that all of us just need to hold on to. Mm-hmm. That it doesn't, we don't need to assign meaning to things, like that. It's no. just, yeah. I mean, so what do we tell people, especially when they feel like, okay, well, you know, you're supposed to be tired. This is just me being tired and I'll snap out of it. And how do we know when it may be more than that?
If you feel like you're drowning, mm-hmm. I feel like that's sign number one, mm-hmm. because yes, you're going to be tired. Yes. You're going to be burnt out. You're going to go through cycles of weird emotions that you can't really put your finger on. But mm-hmm. if it feels like it's just swallowing you whole, and it feels almost like your insides are just like tightening up when you think about certain things, like that to me means you should get help. But, you know, of course there are clinical markers for when you should seek help. If you aren't sleeping, if your changes in appetite, that should have been another red flag. Like, mm-hmm. oh, have you developed a hiatal hernia? You're so stressed. Go to a therapist.
Oh, but it just proves how, maybe especially women, I'll just say that, how we just stick it out.
Well, and that nobody makes the correlation. I think all of the doctors I saw were male. Mm-hmm. And they weren't like, oh, did you just have a baby? Mm-hmm. Are you sleeping? Where are you in the postpartum period? Where's mm-hmm. that hormone drop? Because mm-hmm. like right after baby, it drops like you're going into menopause. Ugh. And then if you're breastfeeding, those shifts continue, because every time baby changes their feeding pattern, your body goes through another rigmarole of yep. hormonal roulette.
Yep.
And some of us are better equipped biologically to handle those shifts. Mm-hmm. Others like me, not. And 1 in 5, 7, whatever, wherever you get your statistics from, too many of us
yes.
also have the same response to those hormonal changes.
So were you scared of second pregnancy, second delivery?
I probably should have been, but I wasn't, because I felt so good at the time. Once I got into therapy and I got on the Zoloft, and everybody knew what was going on. Everybody knew what meds I was on, mm-hmm. that everything was safe for the pregnancy. Like mm-hmm. I felt physically great. Dean was at a really fun age. I didn't want to move to Texas, but we had to. So then, I went to a practice there that was mostly midwives. So I could see, that's who I had all my visits with, and they were great. I found a therapist. I also got a doula, mm-hmm. which was a game changer. I would have sold my soul with my first pregnancy to have one if I knew, now knowing what a big help it was. Like, I cannot stress having a doula enough. If you can afford $1,000, mm-hmm. like skimp on the baby stuff, put it towards the doula. Because it just changed the whole experience. I had somebody who would come to the house and like massage me if I was having like a physically hard time. She was fantastic. And she would just come and like be like, here's some things that we can like do to help like your delivery better. Here's some exercises you can do. She taught Michael how to like counter the contractions so that I could labor at home longer. It was just, she beautiful. Was fantastic. And Michael still, she's like, that was the best money we've ever spent. Like,
yeah.
and she seriously was amazing. And I had a therapist I really loved, and we really tried to like have a game plan. Mm-hmm. We like scheduled I even told my midwife, I was like, it was really bad after my son. I don't want to go through that. Mm-hmm. The second time, I need to have things in place. So my therapist knew we had our follow-up mm-hmm. scheduled for like 2 weeks after delivery. I had awesome. My doula coming in 1 week after delivery. Like, I was like, we are gonna be good. Nope. Mm-hmm. It was like almost immediate. And like the delivery was amazing. I labored at home till I thought I was gonna have it on the floor. And my doula was like, get in the car. We made it to the hospital. They broke my water and my daughter was born in 5 minutes. I mean, I pushed like 3 times. Woo. And so my physical recovery was so much faster. I felt like freaking Wonder Woman.
Yeah.
And I was like, let's go home and do the damn thing. Like, I'm so ready. Let's get this cute little baby home. But it was like, as soon as we got home, I just fell apart. And I think part of it was that was the first time I had spent a night away from our son.
Yeah.
And nobody, again, nobody mm-hmm. talks about it. So I didn't know that I was going to feel this, but I was like grieving mm-hmm. the loss of that, the being just my son's mom.
Yes.
And I was like, I just wanted to be his mom. Now I'm split in two and yes. I love this new baby, but I also just miss being his mom. Like yes. it was so hard. And I felt so much guilt too
yes.
towards both. I was like, I feel so bad that I'm not 100% devoted to him. And I feel so bad to this baby that I feel this way.
Yes.
Oh God, it was just so bad. And again, I feel like if my brain chemistry was strong enough that maybe it would have just been a little blip, you know, baby blues kind of thing. But mm-hmm. that carried on for a good while. Mm-hmm. And I had a lot of breakdowns in my therapist's office. I'll never forget one day I was just in there. I think I had my daughter with me and I just like broke down in tears. I was like, I don't understand why it has to be so hard. And she was just like, you know, I don't know if you are allowed to hug patients or not, but you know, it was one of those situations where she like wanted to, but it's like, yeah. here's some tissues. Like,
oh, it was gosh. So,
you know, just like, I'm yeah. sorry.
It is yeah. so hard. And it just feels so tedious. Everything feels so tedious in that stage. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I had a psychiatrist who she kind of just kept re-diagnosing me. I think she was trying, but she was pregnant at the time. And so, you know, psychiatrists are human too. They have a lot going on. Mm-hmm. And I think they put me on so many different medications that some made it so much worse. I mean, like I had only had one other time in my life with seventh grade, which is a fucking nightmare for most people, where I had even like thought about suicide, mm-hmm. just a blip that was. Mm-hmm. And then with the different medications that they were trying me on to get me to kind of level out, they were sending me into just like spirals of like, why am I here? I don't need to be here. My kids don't deserve this. Like to the point where I was like crying in my closet on the floor, just like, I cannot function. And my husband, again, to the rescue, he was like, you need to find a new psychiatrist. Mm-hmm. But, and I don't know if other people do this too, but I get like, I would get so defensive. I'm like, no, they're really trying to help me. Mm-hmm. And it's like, fine, but they're not.
It's not
so
working.
It's okay to go find somebody else. And sure enough, I found her. She talked to me. She was like, A, you're drinking too much. Mm-hmm. B, this is what I think you have. You need to get off this shit and we need to put you on this thing. Mm-hmm. And she, I mean, I did a ton of like diagnostic tests in her office that I hadn't done before.
Interesting.
And she was just very black and white about it. It was like, this
is
what
you needed at that stage.
Mm-hmm.
You needed someone
and
to
I,
take
And I
charge.
Will say, to credit the first one, she was like, you need to stop breastfeeding because your stress is not helping. Mm-hmm. And it's better that you are healthy than you continue breastfeeding. And she was right, because once I stopped breastfeeding, my daughter was 5 months old. And so she thrived on the formula. She had not been gaining weight as quickly mm-hmm. as Dean had when he was a baby. I didn't know. I was like, oh, it's just because she's a girl and, you know, all babies are different, blah, 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 blah. As soon as we switched, she's just like back to the charts where she's supposed to be. And I was like, well, shit, now I feel even worse.
Oh God. Like, right. It's just another thing that I didn't catch. No, but one of the biggest things I hear in that part of the story is like, even if you like your therapist or your psychiatrist, or there might be some movement happening or whatever, it's okay to call it at some point. And there are different mm-hmm. reasons we do that. Either the movement isn't happening fast enough, or there isn't movement, or for some reason, the connection just feels off. Like it, mm-hmm. we need to be okay with breaking up with our therapist and our psychiatrist yeah. And finding somebody else and getting, sometimes fresh eyes are what we need on our situation. Mm-hmm. So I just think that's an important highlight for listeners too, because breakups are awkward, you know, and like, yeah. therapist, it's still a relationship. So I get a lot of questions about that. Like, how do I break up with a therapist? I'm going to make a note. We'll do another episode on that. But that's what I hear in that is like, you had a team that worked for a certain season, and then you found a new team that was more effective for the next season. That's quite a journey. And so how are you today?
I'm good. I think if we had stayed in Texas, I would not be good. We moved back right before lockdown 2020, back to North Carolina. And I have a fantastic therapist and an amazing psychiatrist. They're probably the best team I've had since my team in Charlotte. I mean, that's not fair. I've been very fortunate, but they're great. Mm-hmm. And they're both very good at holding me accountable. And so I have managed to, you know, survive yes. COVID, my son's first year of school, losing both parents, Michael traveling a lot for work, and, you know, just yeah. doing it. I quit drinking in 2020 because like at the start of the pandemic, I was like, pandemic, nothing matters anymore. Let's just drink all the time. And I was like, well, let's don't do that.
Because of mood, impact on mood.
I was getting like, so one of the things that came up during the postpartum diagnoses were like impulse control. It's like my body's hunt for dopamine was like, mm-hmm. okay, mm-hmm. I'm going to try to do this. And like, yep. so the alcohol played a big part in that. And when I was traveling back and forth to see my mom in Raleigh, when she was just like in terrible shape, when I would leave her, I would go to the gas station and get like a tall boy of White Claw, uh-huh. put it in a cup and drive home 2 hours to Wilmington. And the second time, not the first time, the second time I did that, I was like, bitch, stop. Like, you're done. That was so stupid. And so I'm like 19 months sober now, uh-huh. almost 20 months sober. And that's just going to have to keep going because I don't know how to have just a drink at a normal time.
Yes. So that's really helped.
Being sober has helped. And there are times like anytime these catastrophes happen, I'm like, shit, a drink would be great. But I'm like, would it? I would just spiral more. So it's good. It's forced me to see everything a lot more clearly and kind of really unpack yep. the childhood traumas, the adult traumas, and try to address some of those triggers that I had been self-medicating
and avoiding. So we need a follow-up episode. But thank you for like sharing the ins and outs of so much trauma and grief and resilience, though. I know. I mean, sometimes that's cringy. Like I wish I didn't have to be so resilient, you know, like I didn't want all of these traumas.
Yeah. I don't want to be strong.
But there it is. So like, I really appreciate it. I think it's going to be really helpful for around understanding, particularly like the postpartum stuff that we don't talk about enough. So I really, really appreciate you taking the time to do that.
Sure. Thank you.
So who you calling crazy? I think you mean human. We're removing the stigma, y'all. Say it loud and proud. Yep, I go to therapy.